This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Annette Sanu Clapsaddle spent years working on her first novel, and it received critical acclaim, even won an award, and was a finalist for another. But she couldn't get an agent to publish it, so she started writing a new novel. But this time she signed up for a class with the Great Smokies Writing Program. And that's populated by a deep pool of talented authors in Western North Carolina who supported one another's creative efforts. And through that support, Annette streamlined her writing process. And next month, she's going to publish her new novel, Even As We Breathe. It explores Native stereotypes and questions of identity, both things that she has confronted in her own life. Annette, welcome to The State of Things.
Thank you for having me.
I am really looking forward to exploring that life with you, but let's start with this new novel, Even As We Breathe, out next month. Give us a summary. What's it about?
Sure. Even As We Breathe is set during World War II, one summer during World War II, when the Grove Park Inn Resort in Asheville, North Carolina, held Axis diplomats as prisoners of war for a very brief time. And my protagonist, County, is a young Cherokee man who leaves Cherokee to work at the Grove Park Inn as a member of the grounds crew, and is accused of being involved in the disappearance of a diplomat's daughter. So it's a little bit of a mystery in that regard. And then also he's exploring his own family mystery and what he wants to do with the rest of his life.
I mean, it's a fascinating setup if you think about it. What inspired you to write about that period? And I didn't know that we had Axis diplomats held as prisoners of war during World War II. It's fascinating.
It really is fascinating. The real history is what inspired me for sure. When the movie Monuments Men came out, and I know there was a book before that, but the movie had gotten some press, and I believe it was the Asheville Citizen Times had printed a story about the Biltmore House housing some of and protecting some of the great artistic works that Monuments Men kind of reflected in that movie. And it went on to briefly mention that the Grove Park Inn held Axis diplomats. And I found that really interesting, tried to find a little bit more information on it, and there wasn't a lot out there. There were other resorts that held prisoners of war during that time. I think Hot Springs had a German camp at one point. So the setting itself was really inspiring to me because there were so many questions about it. And then I started thinking about the proximity to Cherokee and questions of citizenship in general. If you are a diplomat during a time of war and then all of a sudden are a prisoner of war, and if you are a Native American during this time period, questions of citizenship are still pretty vague and unsettled during this time period. And I was also aware that during World War II, some POW camps, internment camps were set up on Indian reservations out west. So all of this seemed to raise a lot of questions and a landscape that I could really explore issues of identity and citizenship.
Yeah, it's fascinating to bring those concepts into contact with each other, the idea of sovereignty, diplomatic sovereignty, what that means, how it changes in times of war, what sovereignty means for Native Americans, and put them all together in a place where some of this really took place. Maybe you can bring us into the novel. Can I ask you to read from the beginning for us?
Sure. This is from the prologue. About the place, when I take you there or when you find it on your own, just know that what the old folks say is true. This land is ours because what is buried in the ground, not what words appear on a paper. But also know this, what is buried in the ground isn't always what you think. It's just the beginning. It's the beginning of the story, the beginning of all of us who call ourselves Homo sapiens. Fitting, I guess, that what I found buried, just as I was trying to figure out how to become a man and still be human, was the very thing that threatened to take it all away. Just when I began to see what taking control of my own life might look like, I realized I was not who I thought, and neither was this place. That summer in 1942, when I met her before I found myself in a white man's cage and entangled in the barbed wire that destroyed my father, I left the cage of my home in Cherokee, North Carolina. I left these mountains that both hold and suffocate and went to work at the pinnacle of luxury and privilege, Asheville's Grove Park Inn and Resort. I guess I had convinced myself that I could become fortunate by proximity, escape Uncle Bud's tirades and my grandmother Leishy's empty kitchen cabinets just by driving a couple of hours up the road. It sounded good to tell folks I was raising money for college, but the truth was I didn't know what I was doing. I just didn't want to do it there anymore. And if I stayed any longer, I would become rooted so deeply, I might as well have been buried.
Annette Sanu Clapsaddle reading from her debut novel, Even As We Breathe. Going to be at a virtual book launch at Malaprop's bookstore in Asheville on Tuesday, September 8th. Tell us a little bit more about County now, who is the protagonist. County actually trades the familiar land of Cherokee, which, as you suggest in this prologue, had become uncomfortable for him, for the upscale world of Grove Park Inn. But talk about moving from one world to another and how this plays into the larger themes in your book.
Yeah, County is 19 at the time, and he had explored a little bit with junior college, couldn't quite figure out what he wanted to do. And he's being raised mostly by his grandmother, Leishy, but a little bit by his uncle, Bud. And County's father died really at the after the end of World War One, but he was still overseas with some troops at the end of World War One. And County's mother actually died in childbirth. So the only family that County's been raised by has been a really loving, caring grandmother and a pretty hard-nosed uncle who just wants to make sure that the County is working as much as possible. And so County is kind of at a loss for what he wants to do. Very early on, there's a chapter about kind of the last job he does for Bud, and he realized that that it might cost him his life, at least years off his life, if he had stayed at home. So he's got an internal imagination that makes him interested in what might lie outside of the Qualla boundary, and that leads him to take a job in Asheville for the summer.
Yeah, it's fascinating. He's got an imagination that can drive him, but obviously it can't protect him from all of the dangers and vulnerabilities that he finds himself in when he moves into these other worlds. We'll talk more about that, but I want to hear about your first novel, because this is not your first, Even As We Breathe, which comes out next month. Your first novel was Going to Water. Tell us what that was about.
Sure. Going to Water was loosely based on the character of my grandfather, Osley Bird Sanute. And he was a two-term chief for the Eastern Band and a world heavyweight wrestling champion. He also owned and operated a small business, a souvenir store in Cherokee. So he passed away long before I was born from complications of diabetes. But I grew up hearing all of these stories about him that seemed almost unbelievable, and no one ever told the same story twice, even family members. So he was such a character that I found that writing a fictionalized version of his life was a way for me to hear more stories and kind of understand the underlying themes of his life, even if all the facts of a fictional narrative weren't true. So it really follows his life from growing up in Cherokee, but then going to Chicago to work. And that certainly happened during his lifetime, that there were some public works programs in major cities in the United States for Native Americans. And so he had gone to Chicago and then returned home and pursued professional wrestling and then later politics. It follows that kind of life cycle.
Well, as we said, it got some critical notice, it won an award, and yet you couldn't get it published. Why do you think that was?
I wish I knew. No. You know, the process for publishing now, for the most part, requires an agent. So really going through the process of querying agents to see if there's interest. And there were, you know, I had a few longer conversations with some. It's hard to know for sure. It's difficult to find the right fit, I think, for someone who understands the community that you're talking about when there's no other literature to compare it to. There's certainly other Native novelists out there, but every reservation, every tribal community is very different. So, you know, you may have agents who see a Native author and they're expecting, you know, Sherman Alexie, Louise Erdrich, or, you know, someone that has been more in popular culture. And that's not this community. It's very different. And even some of the newer voices that are out there right now are still not this community. And so there's a kind of an education process, and you've got to sell literature. It can be a tall order.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take a break right now and find out and learn more about the community that you did find, a community of writers that was a little bit more familiar with your situation and how that may have turned the tables and helped you get a book published. We're talking to Annette Clapsaddle, author of Even As We Breathe, comes out next month. We'll find out more on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, talking with Annette Sanuk Clapsaddle. It's her first published novel, and she's the first novelist who is also a published novelist, who's also a member of the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians. Her novel, Even As We Breathe, centers on a Cherokee boy who leaves his community in the summer of 1942 to work a few hours away in Asheville at the Grove Park Inn, where the U.S. Army is housing Axis diplomats during World War II. Annette left a Cherokee community at about the same time as her main character did. She attended Yale University after spending her childhood on the Quala boundary. So, Annette, let's talk a little bit about that, because as you mentioned, I mean, one of the difficulties in finding an agent for your first book was that, you know, understanding particular Native communities can be a challenge, and yours was particular. It's not a Native American place. It is particularly Cherokee and that community. What was it like to grow up there?
You know, I think Cherokee, North Carolina is a mix of Appalachian and Southern culture and Native culture. So it was a unique experience. We're in a rural area right at the entrance to the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. So I spent most of my childhood outside in the woods or in the river and playing with cousins growing up. So, you know, I don't think it was too different than some of my neighbors in surrounding counties. Most folks here grow up outside for a large portion. But there is, you know, the mix of our Cherokee culture, which meant that I grew up with, you know, hearing some of the traditional stories and practices of our culture, but also being in a place where tourism centered on what we shared of our culture with outsiders.
Yeah, I know that one memory that stands out for you is your grandmother's funeral. You were about 13. What do you remember about that?
Sure. My grandmother served on tribal council as a representative for over 25 years. She was very well respected in our community. And I always knew growing up, you know, that she was a council member and served her community. But I remember distinctly how many people came to her funeral and spoke about her really as a selfless leader for our community, that, you know, she would bake cakes for raffles and things like that. And she was always giving as a servant leader, which is really indicative of our traditional forms of leadership in Cherokee, the way they really are meant to be. And so that stood out. I do, like, I have one image that will always stay with me from that funeral. Someone had placed crossed arrows on her chest in the casket. And I will always remember that because I remember someone telling me that that symbolized her journey home as a warrior. And it really stood out to me that this is one of the earliest examples of a true female leader that I had in my life.
You know, it's so interesting to think about how that would have an effect on you, because this is someone you knew. You probably knew about her contributions and the way she was in the community. But now here is your grandmother reflected to you by the community. And I wonder how that changed things for you and what that meant to you to see how the community felt.
Right. Yeah, I think because I always thought of her as my grandmother first, to realize that anyone can have a significant role in the community, can contribute to their community in some way, and to lead a life that serves community. I think that will forever stick with me because of her service and also her strength. You know, she was not a passive woman. And I think that and seeing the recognition of that as accepted in our community verified for me that I could also be a strong woman, that some traditional gender roles that we think about in Western culture don't quite hold in Cherokee culture.
Talk about your elementary school experience. You didn't go to school on the Quala boundary, right? But there's still a lot of Cherokee kids in your class. So talk about that experience.
Sure. I went to school at Smoky Mountain Elementary in Jackson County, and it's right off the Quala boundary. So we had a high population of Cherokee students there as well. Very close knit. It was kindergarten through eighth grade. Had some of the best teachers for my English and social studies classes, especially the classes that I really was interested in. And early on, I was able to start writing in their classes. I have some of these books from, I think, second grade where that we made and wrote little stories in. But those teachers were really formative in providing examples of how to nurture young people, to find out what they're interested in, to recognize that everyone has different gifts.
So it wasn't all reflected in the grades on the core curricula, right? I mean, they were recognizing other kinds of talents. Were you a budding writer at the time? Were you thinking about writing, or were you thinking about just getting through?
Yeah, I was always trying to write. I think I think since the time that I could put sentences together, I was writing stories. I joke that one of the first stories I tried to write, I still remember the book. It was like a pink book that I tried. The first story was about a lighthouse in Maine, which I had, of course, no experience with. But that was early in elementary school.
Yeah. Well, so then you went to high school. That was a different experience for you, right? Not as many Native students there.
Right. I went to high school in Silva, North Carolina, at Smoky Mountain High School, still in Jackson County, but it was a little bit more distant from the Quala boundary and fewer Native students there, though we did have a certain population of Native students. And as high schools tend to be, you lose track of some of that closeness that an elementary middle school can have in terms of community. And so everybody kind of fell into their different roles in school, whether it be academically tracked classes or sports or clubs.
Yeah, I know that you have one vivid memory that you comment on from time to time, and this was a story about your boyfriend at the time.
Yeah. This was early in high school, and I was walking down the hall with a boyfriend I had at the time who was not Cherokee, and we passed one of his teammates from the football team, and he looked, he spoke to him, and then as we passed by, my boyfriend said to me, "Lazy Indian," and I was so set aback. I was shocked that he would say something like that, because his teammate was one of my very good friends from throughout elementary and middle school. And it also reminded me that apparently my boyfriend had forgotten that I was also Cherokee, which happened a lot because of the way I look. It was easy for folks to forget my ties to that community. So that relationship immediately ended.
Were you aware? I mean, how did that, because you talked about being in elementary school, a nurturing environment, lots more Native kids around you. Did you become more aware and of your Native identity in high school where there were fewer Native students?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I became more protective of my friends in a lot of ways, in terms that maybe they were struggling to navigate high school that was set up a little bit differently. So my friends who were from the Qualla boundary, it made me aware that they weren't necessarily always treated the same as some of my non-Native friends. And it made me a little bit more aware, not as much aware as I became when I went to college, I think.
You were class president your senior year in high school, and you and the other class officers actually helped stage a protest. Tell us that story.
Sure, yeah. So my senior year, we were the first class where it was required that we do a senior project. So this was a year-long process, required a paper and internship and product and all that. And we were told that we had to do it or we would not graduate. And near the end of our senior year, I had a vice principal pull me out of class and say that there was an issue with a student who had not completed any of the work but had some political ties in the community. And our administrators at the high school were being pressured to let this student pass anyway. And so our administrators had opposed that. And there was going to be a school board meeting that night. So I was able to pull our other class officers together. And by the end of the day, we had a meeting with our senior class in the cafeteria and discussed the issue with everybody and how they felt about it. And the class as a whole organized to meet up later and drive over to the school board meeting later that evening and show our support of our administrators and upholding the policy.
What happened?
They upheld the policy. And so the student had to, I believe, that summer complete the requirements before officially graduating.
Kind of interesting that your local, that the building administrators, your principal and vice principal, were prepared apparently to challenge this. I mean, that they're doing that, I guess, taking some risk. Did you have a sense that they were taking a risk themselves?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I was really surprised when the vice principal came to me and got me out of class. I mean, that's, you know, you don't normally see that in a high school where an administrator is having to make a stand and then will also involve students so directly in that. So I knew that there was a lot on the line.
The vice principal was always taking me out of class in high school, but it wasn't wasn't to organize a protest. It was to end a protest usually. But what did you take away from that? For you, I mean, as a student now moving on to, you know, on your way to college, and we'll talk about that, what was the takeaway for you in all of that?
The takeaway for me was the cohesiveness with which we were able to address the school board. We had, you know, a lot of different groups of students. And, you know, you think of the stereotypical high school experience with different cliques and whatnot. And our senior class was a little bit different. We all kind of got along across different groups. And we're all on the same page when it came to fairness and doing, you know, what was right. And so, I guess I could have personally taken it upon myself to go to the school board and speak on behalf of our class, assuming I knew what they wanted. But it was far more effective to really find out what our class wanted to do as a whole and then for us all to be bought into what action to take.
Great stuff. At that point, did you also know where you were headed with your career?
I've always wanted to be a teacher. You know, before I was even in kindergarten, I used to pretend to play school out in our yard. So I think I always knew that I wanted to be a teacher.
You ended up at Yale, but you had a lot of choices. Talk about going to Yale and where else you might have gone.
Sure. So when I was in high school, I really didn't even think about applying to Ivy Leagues until my senior year. My mother had gone to Wake Forest. She played on the first basketball team at Wake Forest. And I really considered going there and was accepted there. The first place that I was accepted was Dartmouth. And so Dartmouth does a really nice job of recruiting Native students. And so they were on my radar my senior year. We had a family friend who had attended there. And then I got a call from a recruiter who ended up becoming a mentor, Rick Chavoya, who asked me, you know, if I was interested in applying to Yale. And my parents said that if I wanted to apply, that they would pay for the application fee. But I think we all thought I wouldn't get in. But I did. I applied and was accepted there and ended up really choosing between, of course, you know, there were some other colleges in the mix.
Yeah, Wake Forest as well, right?
Right, yes. Yeah. Yeah, I was accepted to Wake Forest. So it really came down to whether I wanted to stay in the South and go to Wake Forest or go north and go to Yale.
You chose Yale. Why?
I chose Yale primarily because when I went to visit and I stepped on campus, it absolutely felt right. And, you know, there's no denying that Yale has a fantastic reputation, so I wasn't worried about the academics there. But it just felt like a welcoming place. I had gone to visit a couple of colleges that spring, and Dartmouth for one, and everything went wrong when I went to visit Dartmouth. Our rental car got towed, and the person I was supposed to stay with never showed up. You know, just those things that can happen. And so it seemed like the stars were aligned when I stepped on the campus of Yale.
And I think you remember the day, you tell the story about the day that you actually got into Dartmouth. You were accepted there because your mom called the school and the secretary asked about the call. Tell us what happened next.
Yeah, I was called to the office and to take the call from my mother. And so my mother tells me over the phone, this is when we used to get real letters instead of email, tells me over the phone that I had gotten an acceptance letter from Dartmouth. I got off the phone, and the secretary, who I guess thought that this was her business, asked what the call was about. And I said, oh, I got into Dartmouth. And she said, are you going to play basketball there? And I said, no, I don't think so. And she said, oh, well.
Because you were a pretty good basketball player, right?
I was a pretty good basketball player, yes.
And apparently basketball was a pretty big deal at your school because it disappointed her that you weren't going to play.
Apparently, yes. You know, I think sports are pretty important to high schools in this area in general.
Well, you did go to Yale, and you were part of the Association of Native Americans there. You also, we didn't mention this before, but you have a biracial identity, right? Your mother is white. And so how did all of that play out at Yale?
Sure. So, you know, freshman year of any college experience is trying to figure out where your place is. And so because of the way that I physically present, the way that I look, it's not obvious that I'm Native American. And I'm always aware of that, especially when I am approaching other Native groups, because there is also this problem of folks who are not Native American who claim to be. And so I don't ever want to come across as one of those people who is just pretending to be Native for whatever reason people do that. And so it took me a little while to kind of approach and feel comfortable being a part of the Native American Association, but it really became a second home for me. Other Native students from all over the country were a part. It's a small group. There's, you know, a very small percentage of Native students at Yale, but we became very close. And they, and little by little, they got to know me. They knew, you know, where I was from, and that that if you get to know me at all, then it's pretty obvious I'm not faking anything. So,
but you know, this question.
So we were,
okay. Well, I want you to finish that, but I mean, maybe you can incorporate it into this next question, which is this whole business about being Native American, as you say, people from all over the country, meaning bringing very different backgrounds. So where did you feel something in common, and how did it feel different?
Yeah, that's a good point, because we are from different states, you know, across the country. Most of us who came from Native communities were coming from rural communities. So I think that that's one touchstone that we had in common. But just, you know, our experience, there are certain things that most Native communities have in common, like a shared sense of humor that's kind of hard to categorize, an understanding of what family means, and then just a different perspective on being an American citizen and having ancestors who were on this land long before there was an America. I think that just kind of shines through regardless of what Native community you come from. And so we had those things in common.
We will talk more with Annette Sanu-Clapsaddle, author of the new novel, Even As We Breathe. There's more just ahead on The State of Things. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Annette Clapsaddle, author of the new novel, Even As We Breathe. Annette is also an English teacher at Swain County High School. But before you got there, and we talked about going to Yale, after Yale, you went to the College of William and Mary for grad school. Tell us a little bit about that.
After undergraduate, I wanted to move south. I knew that, but I was an American Studies major and wanted to pursue my master's degree also in American Studies. And the College of William and Mary had a program that interested me, the professors that I'd like to study with. So it was a pretty quick experience, though, for me. I was really ready to work after undergraduate, but knew I wanted to go ahead and get my master's degree, and William and Mary seemed like a nice transition place, coming from Yale and the feel of Yale, but heading a little further south.
A nice place in the south with a good American Studies program, and yet you had a run-in with one of the American Studies professors. Tell us about that.
Well, technically this professor was in a different department, but I took a Native history class with a professor who had also happened to have graduated from Yale, but he graduated before there were women at Yale. And his research, at least partly, focused on Cherokee. And so I was used to an atmosphere at Yale where it's very conversational with professors, and you could debate in class with professors. And that was not necessarily the environment of that class that I was in graduate school. So when the professor brought up, I think the topic was booger mask in Cherokee ceremony, and he made a comment that I disagreed with. I thought that it was inaccurate, and I guess made the mistake of saying so in class. And between me saying that, and then we had a conversation in his office later about the fact that I was a woman and had gone to Yale, and he kind of looked at me like, that doesn't happen. I think that I wasn't on his best side for the rest of class, and so the only C I received in graduate school was in American Indian History.
I'm sorry, that tells whatever tale you need to hear. I don't think we even need to go on. But it would be telling to know exactly what the disagreement was about. What was he saying about that dance, and where did you correct him?
Yeah, so he was saying that booger masks that are and I should clarify, booger meaning an evil spirit of some kind. So the booger masks that the Cherokee wore were a symbol of them being ashamed of smallpox scars because of the smallpox that come through, and that's not accurate. They represent evil, and specifically in the form of illness that is brought in from the outside.
Hmm. So a relation, but obviously not the direct link that he wanted to draw.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, now you started teaching at Swain County High School in Bryson City, right? Tell us about that decision to do that and what you found when you got there.
Yeah, so when I went into teaching, I had been, I briefly worked at the Cherokee Preservation Foundation, and then I worked for Chief Hicks administration, the principal chief at the time in Cherokee for about 3 years. But I knew I wanted to go into teaching, and it was the right time. and so I came to Swain County High School to teach English and, well, eventually Cherokee Studies, but not when I first started teaching. And then coach women's basketball here. And Swain County High School is a very small, rural high school and a very close community, but with some incredible educators on par with any educators in the state.
But you had that, and not but the fact is, and the fact is, you had an Ivy League education, you know, an advanced degree, and you had a great job with the Cherokee Preservation Foundation. You were working, as you say, with Chief Hicks at some point. You know, what about those jobs? Because I'm only guessing that you were even making a little bit more money.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, later on in my career, I actually went back to the foundation to be the director and was definitely making more money there. And I have students every year when they find out my background, ask me why I am teaching at Swain County High School. But I had a professor at Yale who was in charge of the teacher prep program who told me that the best use of a Yale education or a quality education in general was to share it. And in teaching public high school is the best place to share an education. You know, it's access to everyone. And I just enjoy that. I enjoy learning with students. I enjoy being around my colleagues who are the hardest workers I have ever been around. And the challenges, you know, today is our first day with students at Swain High School. And you talk about some problem solvers, our staff and administrators and all my colleagues are constantly solving problems, and I like what that does for me mentally.
Well, talk about the problems you're facing today. As you say, first day back, you've got some kids in the building. What's it like? What's going on today?
It's very strange. We have half of our kids today and tomorrow. We have all virtual Wednesday, and then the other half Thursday and Friday for those kids that aren't doing virtual all the time. So we have extremely small class sizes. I have a large classroom, and my max class size is 10. Everyone is in mask all the time. There's tape on the floor for social distancing. We're taking our kids to lunch and sitting with them to ensure that they're social distance. So it's really strange how quiet the school is. One, because we have less students. Two, because everyone's wearing masks, but also people are just really trying to figure out what's going on. You know, and I'm spraying desks down with cleaner after every class. It's a very strange experience.
Well, those challenges that a lot of people are experiencing these days, but also if you think about Swain County, at Bryson City, apparently there's a lot of land base there is federal land, so there's a smaller tax base. I mean, talk about the challenges of just teaching in that school and kind of like what, you know, give us a maybe another sense of the community.
Yeah, it's an immense challenge that I think is vastly misunderstood. We do, you know, we have the Qualla boundary, we have the national park. So much of our land is not taxable, which means when we talk about funding from the state for education, it's based on taxable land. And so, you know, it's a double whammy. We're not getting taxes, property taxes.
Right.
not getting property taxes, and then the state, the calculations that the state does means that we're getting less funding. We do get some federal funding, but it doesn't even out. And we also don't have a supplement. Our county doesn't provide a teaching supplement, so we are some of the lowest paid school employees in the state. And that means that everybody is doing multiple jobs. The central office, everyone at the central office has multiple jobs. We have mandates to keep class sizes small, especially in the elementary school, I think was the latest mandate. This is prior to COVID, but there's no money for more teachers. So it's extremely difficult. There's very little money for public schools in Swain County.
How do kids feel about education just in general? Because I know that you like to have conversations about college with your kids. You teach English, right? How does that go? Are people surprised? Is everybody expecting to go to college? Talk about those conversations.
Yeah, there's certainly a mix of students. I mean, we have in the last few years consistently sent kids to Ivy League schools or some of the top schools in the country, like Stanford, and of course the North Carolina schools like UNC Chapel Hill and NC State. We're very consistent, especially in the last few years, of being able to do that. West Point, places like that. And we're really strong with our CTE program. So we have a lot of students in partnership with Southwestern Community College who pursue community college and then go on to trade schools. And then you've got, this mix of students who are really trying to figure out what they want to do. A lot of students will go into the military or go straight to work after high school. It really is the gamut. But I tend to see more students considering college now. The tribe does pay for college education for enrolled members, so our enrolled member students have more opportunity to go to college.
It's interesting to think about you teaching there as well, because if we get back to your novel, and I want to talk more about that, Even As We Breathe, again, these questions of identities, multiple identities, mountain identity, native identity, as you navigate those and look at what that means for student outcomes, do you have to put yourself in a couple of different places, or is this one large community with a central set of issues and challenges?
A lot of times it feels like one large community, and it really just depends on the issue at hand. There are some times when it feels like different communities and I have to place myself in different spaces. You and I talked off radio a little while ago about COVID and its impact in our area, and we were talking about the Eastern Band's response to COVID-19. That's a very different response than other communities that I engage with, just for a lot of reasons that revolve around sovereignty for the most part. So it really depends on the issues. But when we look at things like generational poverty and isolation, that kind of runs the gamut across all the communities I'm a part of.
And the Eastern Band took it very seriously very early and has better outcomes is one of the ways in which things are different. I want to get back to the book again and again, this whole question of communities, because we talked about the fact that your first book played to some critical acclaim and yet wasn't published. The second was. But talk about the group that you became a part of that may have helped you break through, the writers group.
Mm-hmm. So I was a little dismayed and I had shelved the first novel. And so I decided I would take a writing class, like a workshop class through the Great Smoky Writers Program in Asheville, North Carolina. And I signed up for a class with Heather Newton. She was the instructor, and it was called Get Her Done, Write Your Novel. And the structure of the class, the assignments really revolved around writing a synopsis, which is the most difficult thing to do. And then writing a beginning chapter, a final chapter, and a climactic chapter. of the novel. And that provided for me a structure that I could work with as a full-time teacher and mother of two. I have very little extra, everybody has very little extra time, but I needed some kind of structure when I had pockets of time to write that I knew exactly where I was going. And so that class was able to provide that structure.
Structure, and was there something about, too, because I've seen you talk about the fact that there was a deeper understanding of mountain culture in general and this way to sort of navigate also the publishing world and try to position your novel in a way that agents and publishers would understand.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of crossover between, you know, the Cherokee community and Appalachian culture in general. And I will say, you know, when I became involved with Hindman Settlement School and the Appalachian Writers Workshop, which was after the Asheville Workshop, it even deepened that understanding that there's a lot of similarities in Appalachian culture and how you represent diversity in Appalachia, which, you know, led to some early conversations with my would-be editor and mentor Silas House about how Appalachia is represented. So when I became kind of more a part of that Appalachian Writers Workshop, I was exposed to many different writers across the region who have been grappling with how to explain what it's like to really live here and not be a stereotype.
Well, tell us a little more about those conversations with Silas House. Were they revealing to you? Did they show you things about the way these are represented that you hadn't really considered before?
I think they were affirming. You know, Silas talks a lot about what it's like to be homosexual and write about homosexuality in Appalachia when a lot of people don't understand how those two worlds coexist. And we talked about how that's similar to being Native American in Appalachia and, you know, a culture that's sometimes erased in Appalachian narratives. And so it was really affirming to see how such an accomplished writer like Silas House is able to bridge the gap between what people think they know about place and what that place is really, truly, authentically about in a way that's approachable for any reader.
Annette Sanuk-Clapsaddle, the author of Even As We Breathe and an English teacher at Swain County High School. Today's the first day back. Annette, thanks so much for taking time to talk with us.
Oh, I enjoyed it. Thank you very much for having me.
And that's going to be at a virtual launch at Malaprop's Bookstore in Asheville Tuesday, September 8th, several other upcoming events. And you can find them all at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things produced by Anita Rao, Amanda Magnus, Grant Hullab-Mormon, Kaya Findlay, and Stacia Brown. Jenny Lawson's our technical director. Al Widarski helped engineer the show today as well. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.